Section 11 of The Princess and the Goblin. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Lizzie Driver. The Princess and the Goblin by George MacDonald. Chapters 19 to 20. Chapter 19. Goblin Councils. He must have slept a long time, for when he awoke he felt wonderfully restored, indeed almost well, and very hungry. There were voices in the outer cave. Once more, then, it was night, for the goblins slept during the day and went about their affairs during the night. In the universal and constant darkness of their dwelling, they had no reason to prefer the one arrangement to the other, but from aversion to the sun people they chose to be busy when there was least chance of their being met, either by the miners below when they were burrowing, or by the people of the mountain above, when they were feeding their sheep or catching their goats. And indeed, it was only when the sun was away that the outside of the mountain was sufficiently like their own dismal regions to be endurable to their mole eyes. So thoroughly had they become unaccustomed to any light beyond that of their own fires and torches. Curdie listened, and soon found that they were talking of himself.
"How long will it take?" asked Harelip.
"Not many days, I should think," answered the king. "They are poor, feeble creatures, those sun people, and want to be always eating. We can go a week at a time without food, and be all the better for it. But I have been told they eat two or three times every day. Can you believe it? They must be quite hollow inside. Not at all like us, nine-tenths of whose bulk is solid flesh and bone. Yes, I judge a week of starvation will do for him."
"If I may be allowed a word," interposed the queen, "and I think I ought to have some voice in the matter."
"The wretch is entirely at your disposal, my spouse," interrupted the king. "He is your property. You caught him yourself. We should never have done it."
The queen laughed. She seemed in far better humour than the night before.
"I was about to say," she resumed, "that it does seem a pity to waste so much fresh meat." "What are you thinking of, my love?" asked the king. "The very notion of starving him implies that we are not going to give him any meat, either salt or fresh."
"I'm not such a stupid as that comes to," returned Her Majesty. "What I mean is that by the time he is starved there will hardly be a picking upon his bones."
The king gave a great laugh. "Well, my spouse, you may have him when you like," he said. "I don't fancy him for my part. I am pretty sure he is tough eating."
"That would be to honour instead of punish his insolence," returned the queen. "But why should our poor creatures be deprived of so much nourishment? Our little dogs and cats and pigs and small bears would enjoy him very much."
"You are the best of housekeepers, my lovely queen," said her husband. "Let it be so, by all means. Let us have our people in, and get him out, and kill him at once. He deserves it. The mischief he might have brought upon us, now that he had penetrated so far as our most retired citadel, is incalculable. Or rather, let us tie him hand and foot, and have the pleasure of seeing him torn to pieces by full torchlight in the great hall."
"Better and better,"
cried the queen and the prince together, both of them clapping their hands. And the prince made an ugly noise with his hare-lip, just as if he had intended to be one at the feast.
"But," added the queen, bethinking herself, "he is so troublesome, for poor creatures as they are, there is something about those sun people that is very troublesome. I cannot imagine how it is that with such superior strength and skill and understanding as ours, we permit them to exist at all. Why do we not destroy them entirely, and use their cattle and grazing lands at our pleasure? Of course we don't want to live in their horrid country. It is far too glaring for our quieter and more refined tastes. But we might use it as a sort of outhouse, you know. Even our creatures' eyes might get used to it, and if they did grow blind, that would be of no consequence, provided they grew fat as well. But we might even keep their great cows and other creatures,
and then we should have a few more luxuries, such as cream and cheese, which at present we only taste occasionally when our brave men have succeeded in carrying some off from their farms."
"It is worth thinking of," said the king, "and I don't know why you should be the first to suggest it, except that you have a positive genius for conquest. But still, as you say, there is something very troublesome about them, and it would be better, as I understand you to suggest, that we should starve him for a day or two first, so that he may be a little less frisky when we take him out.
Once there was a goblin living in a hole, busy he was cobblin' a shoe without a sole. By came a birdie, goblin, what do you do? Cobble at a sturdy upon leather shoe. 'What's that, good old sir?' says the little bird. 'Why, it's very pat, sir, plain without a word. Where 'tis all a hole, sir, never can be holes. Why should their shoes have soles, sir, when they've got no souls?'
'What's that horrible noise?'
cried the queen, shuddering from pot-metal head to granite shoes.
'I declare,' said the king, with solemn indignation, 'it's the sun creature in the hole.'
'Stop that disgusting noise,' cried the crown prince valiantly, getting up and standing in front of the heap of stones, with his face towards Curdie's prison. 'Do now, or I'll break your head.'
'Back away,' shouted Curdie, and began singing again. 'Once there was a goblin living in a hole.'
'I really cannot bear it,' said the queen. 'If only I could get at his horrid toes with my slippers again.'
'I think we had better go to bed,' said the king.
'It's not time to go to bed,' said the queen.
'I would if I was you,' said Curdie.
'Impertinent wretch,'
said the queen, with the utmost scorn in her voice.
'An impossible if,' said his majesty with dignity. 'Quite,' replied Curdie, and began singing again. 'Go to bed, goblin, do help the queen take off her shoe. If you do, it will disclose a horrid set of sprouting toes.'
'What a lie!'
roared the queen in a rage.
'By the way, that reminds me,' said the king, 'that for as long as we have been married, I have never seen your feet, queen. I think you might take off your shoes when you go to bed. They positively hurt me sometimes.'
'I will do as I like,' retorted the queen sulkily.
'You ought to do as your own hubby wishes you,' said the king.
'I will not,' said the queen.
'Then I insist upon it,' said the king.
Apparently his majesty approached the queen for the purpose of following the advice given by Curdie, for the latter heard a scuffle, and then a great roar from the king.
'Will you be quiet, then?' said the queen wickedly.
'Yes, yes, queen, I only meant to coax you.'
'Hands off,' cried the queen triumphantly. 'I am going to bed. You may come when you like, but as long as I am queen, I will sleep in my shoes. It is my royal privilege. Harelip, go to bed.'
'I'm going,' said Harelip sleepily.
'So am I,' said the king.
'Come along, then,' said the queen, 'and mind you're good, or I'll—' 'Oh, no, no, no,' screamed the king, in the most supplicating of tones.
Curdie heard only a muttered reply in the distance, and then the cave was quite still. They had left the fire burning, and the light came through brighter than before. Curdie thought it was time to try again, if anything could be done, but he found he could not even get a finger through the chink between the slab and the rock. He gave a great rush with his shoulder against the slab, but it yielded no more than if it had been part of the rock. All he could do was to sit down and think again. By and by he came to the resolution to pretend to be dying, in the hope they might take him out before his strength was too much exhausted to let him have a chance. Then, for the creatures, if he could but find his axe again, he would have no fear of them. And if it were not for the queen's horrid shoes, he would have no fear at all. Meantime, until they should come again at night, there was nothing for him to do but forge new rhymes, now his only weapons. He had no intention of using them at present, of course, but it was well to have a stock, for he might live to want them, and the manufacture of them would help to while away the time. Chapter 20. Irene's Clue. That same morning early, the princess woke in a terrible fright. There was a hideous noise in her room, creatures snarling and hissing and rocketing about as if they were fighting. The moment she came to herself, she remembered something she had never thought of again, what her grandmother told her to do when she was frightened. She immediately took off her ring and put it under her pillow. As she did so, she fancied she felt a finger and thumb take it gently from her palm. "It must be my grandmother," she said to herself, and the thought gave her such courage that she stopped to put on her dainty little slippers before running from the room. While doing this, she caught sight of a long cloak of sky blue, thrown over the back of a chair by the bedside. She had never seen it before, but it was evidently waiting for her. She put it on, and then, feeling with the forefinger of her right hand, soon found her grandmother's thread, which she proceeded at once to follow, expecting it would lead her straight up the old stair. When she reached the door, she found it went down, and ran along the floor, so that she almost had to crawl in order to keep a hold of it. Then, to her surprise, and somewhat to her dismay, she found that instead of leading her towards the stair, it turned in quite the opposite direction. It led her through certain narrow passages towards the kitchen, turning aside ere she reached it, and guiding her to a door which communicated with a small backyard. Some of the maids were already up, and this door was standing open. Across the yard the thread still ran along the ground, until it brought her to a door in the wall which opened upon the mountainside. When she had passed through, the thread rose up about half her height, and she could hold it with ease as she walked. It led her straight up the mountain. The cause of her alarm was less frightful than she supposed. The cook's great black cat, pursued by the housekeeper's terrier, had bounced against her bedroom door, which had not been properly fastened, and the two had burst into the room together and commenced a battle royale. How the nurse came to sleep through it was a mystery, but I suspect the old lady had something to do with it. It was a clear, warm morning. The wind blew deliciously over the mountainside. Here and there she saw a late primrose, but she did not stop to call upon them. The sky was mottled with small clouds. The sun was not yet up, but some of their fluffy edges had caught his light, and hung out orange and gold-coloured fringes upon the air. The dew lay in round drops upon the leaves, and hung like tiny diamond earrings from the blades of grass about her path. "How lovely that bit of gossamer is," thought the princess, looking at a long undulating line that shone at some distance from her up the hill. It was not the time for gossamers, though, and Irene soon discovered that it was her own thread she saw shining on before her in the light of the morning. It was leading her she knew not whither. But she had never in her life been out before sunrise, and everything was so fresh and cool and lively, and full of something coming, that she felt too happy to be afraid of anything. After leading her up a good distance, the thread turned to the left, and down the path upon which she and Lootie had met Curdie. But she never thought of that, for now in the morning light, with its far outlook over the country, no path could have been more open and airy and cheerful. She could see the road almost to the horizon, along which she had so often watched her King Papa and his troop come shining, with the bugle blast cleaving the air before them, and it was like a companion to her. Down and down the path went, then up, and then down, and then up again, getting rugged and more rugged as it went. And still along the path went the silvery thread, and still along the thread went Irene's little rose-tipped forefinger. By and by she came to a little stream that jabbered and prattled down the hill, and up the side of the stream went both path and thread. And still the path grew rougher and steeper, and the mountain grew wilder, till Irene began to think she was going a very long way from home. And when she turned to look back, she saw that the level country had vanished, and the rough, bare mountain had closed in about her. But still, on went the thread, and on went the princess. Everything around her was getting brighter and brighter as the sun came nearer, till at length his first rays all at once alighted on the top of a rock before her, like some golden creature fresh from the sky. Then she saw that the little stream ran out of a hole in that rock, that the path did not go past the rock, and that the thread was leading her straight up to it. A shudder ran through her from head to foot when she found that the thread was actually taking her into the hole out of which the stream ran. It ran out babbling joyously, but she had to go in. She did not hesitate. Right into the hole she went, which was high enough to let her walk without stooping. For a little way there was a brown glimmer, but at the first turn it all but ceased, and before she had gone many paces she was in total darkness. Then she began to be frightened indeed. Every moment she kept feeling the thread backwards and forwards, and as she went farther and farther into the darkness of the great hollow mountain, she kept thinking more and more about her grandmother, and all that she had said to her, and how kind she had been, and how beautiful she was, and all about her lovely room, and the fire of roses, and the great lamp that sent its light through stone walls. And she became more and more sure that the thread could not have gone there of itself, and that her grandmother must have sent it. But it tried her dreadfully when the path went down very steep, and especially when she came to places where she had to go down rough stairs, and even sometimes a ladder. Through one narrow passage after another, over lumps of rock and sand and clay, the thread guided her, until she came to a small hole through which she had to creep. Finding no change on the other side, "Shall I ever get back?" she thought, over and over again, wondering at herself that she was not 10 times more frightened, and often feeling as if she were only walking in the story of a dream. Sometimes she heard the noise of water, a dull gurgling inside the rock. By and by she heard the sounds of blows, which came nearer and nearer, but again they grew duller and almost died away. In 100 directions she turned, obedient to the guiding thread. At last she spied a dull red shine, and came upon the mica window, and thence away and round about, and right into a cavern, where glowed the red embers of a fire. Here the thread began to rise. It rose as high as her head, and higher still. What should she do if she lost her hold? She was pulling it down. She might break it. She could see it far up, glowing as red as her fire opal in the light of the embers. But presently she came to a huge heap of stones, piled in a slope against the wall of the cavern. On these she climbed, and soon recovered the level of the thread, only, however, to find, the next moment, that it vanished through the heap of stones, and left her standing on it, with her face to the solid rock. For one terrible moment she felt as if her grandmother had forsaken her. The thread which the spiders had spun far over the seas, which her grandmother had sat in the moonlight and spun again for her, which she had tempered in the rose fire and tied to her opal ring, had left her, had gone where she could no longer follow it, had brought her into a horrible cavern and there left her. She was forsaken indeed. "When shall I wake?" she said to herself in an agony, but the same moment she knew it was no dream. She threw herself upon the heap and began to cry. It was well she did not know what creatures, one of them with stone shoes on her feet, were lying in the next cave. But neither did she know who was on the other side of the slab. At length the thought struck her that at least she could follow the thread backwards, and thus get out of the mountain and home. She rose at once and found the thread.
but the instant she tried to feel it backwards, it vanished from her touch. Forwards it led her hand up to the heap of stones. Backwards it seemed nowhere. Neither could she see it as before in the light of the fire. She burst into a wailing cry and again threw herself down on the stones. End of section 11.